A Matter of Scale, Chapter 10. Why Does It Matter? The Cultural Test. I was listening to the news on the radio the other day. It was an article about the UK armed forces in Afghanistan losing soldiers because of a lack of decent armoured vehicles. The phrase that struck me was the same one that other writers have picked up on. Our armed forces. I don't remember being asked for permission for my armed forces to fight in Afghanistan. Nor did I realise that I even had any armed forces that I could ask to fight on my behalf. It turns out that my sister has some armed forces too, and my best friend, and my neighbours who go everywhere by car. We all have to share the same armed forces, of course. Well, at least if you're in the same country as me. But then, who are the other people in Afghanistan, the NATO lot? And there are lots of United Nations forces trying to sort out problems in West Africa. Are they all mine? Which ones belong to me? I'm getting confused. The problem with trying to ascertain which culture you belong to is that there seem to be so many different ones to choose from. I could easily put myself in the following social, racial, religious, etc. groups. Earth dweller, European, white, non-religious, British, English. All pretty standard stuff and none of them contradictory. Or are they? Britain is a Christian nation according to various religious people I hear on the radio. I can be an earth dweller and white for sure, but does this recognition of my global position mean I've opted out of any regional or national geographical identity? In fact, your cultural identity is a mix of just about anything you want it to be. Football team, favourite brand of cola, sexual orientation, hair colour. However you position yourself amongst others though, you probably feel you belong in one of the few dominant cultures on the planet, and almost certainly the one you've been born into. Someone born in North America, Europe, Australasia, certain states in Asia, South Africa and many other parts of the world would have been dominated from birth by a culture that is predominantly Christian, at all points along the belief spectrum, and which is centred on the acquisition of money and property through the production of goods. This culture has a tendency towards high consumption, high pollution, the private ownership of land and property, representative democracy, the English language and a relatively free press and media. This culture is usually known by a combination of the words industrial, western and capitalist, though there are many other names for it. There are variations on the predominant features, especially in the use of language, but in general that's about the size of it. Many other people, or rather their governments and especially their business leaders, aspire to be like those in the industrial capitalist West. Religions provide some resistance, especially where the church and state are closely linked. Iran, Nigeria and Pakistan are examples. But even where religious belief is strong, like in the USA or Italy, the high consumption, high pollution norms seem to do fine, or even thrive on such beliefs. Huge population centres, like those of India and China, accounting for nearly 2.5 billion people between them, have their own cultural systems which originate from a combination of theistic and secular beliefs. But the wholehearted embrace of capitalism by both nations, if not that of the appearance of a democracy or a free press, suggests that other truly distinct cultures are more of the exception rather than the norm. I don't think I would be insulting many people by making an assumption that the majority of people reading this fall within the same basic culture that I was brought up in. If you are not, then you may come out of this test better than the people who have the majority of financial wealth on this planet. One way of getting towards the level of objectivity needed for the cultural test is by looking at the dominant symbols of a culture and working out what they say about the people within it. That can be complicated, but also very enlightening. I put together a montage of various logos, which you can see on the website or in the book, because it seems to me that if you can bring about many of the symbols of the culture, you can create something that actually resembles that culture. When I went about choosing the logos, I selected those I thought most people would be able to recognise throughout the entire Western industrial capitalist culture. Most of them are commercial, which is not surprising considering the importance of commerce in almost every aspect of the culture. Some of them are media organisations like the BBC, CNN and MTV, which signifies the importance of the media in defining cultural inputs from day to day. Very few are non-commercial. The Red Cross, Red Crescent, the Star of David, the Christian Cross and the WWF Panda among them. There are lots missing, of course, but overall I think the montage fairly represents the priorities of this culture. The message this gives to me is that much of humanity has become a commercial entity. No longer are we about subsistence, despite the rich, fulfilling life that, as you've seen, it can entail. There is apparently far more to life than this. We enjoy listening to music, watching TV, buying toys, clothes, cars and computers, eating fast food, flying to far off places and, when it suits us, giving a little money to charity. We even pray, for others and ourselves, for longer lives, for healthier lives, for the dead, for the living, to make us wealthy, to make us happy. Some of us pray for a healthier natural environment. Some of us try to create a healthier natural environment. When it comes down to it, though, it's really all about taking what we want, so long as we can afford it. Humans are vital. Humans are relevant. Humans are irrelevant. Which is it to be? The predominant culture is one that certainly puts humans at the centre of things, so it's clear that humans cannot be irrelevant. But does this culture really suggest humans are vital? In this culture, wars are started and countries are invaded, within and beyond its cultural boundaries. In this culture, only some people have access to universal health care, and commercial pressure is encouraging those countries that do have it to privatise their health provision. In this culture, heavy metals are released into the water and air. Organophosphates and other long-lived human toxic chemicals are widely used in poorly controlled conditions. Corporations lobby to prevent the control of cancer-causing substances. In this culture, humans are warming the earth as a byproduct of the commercialism that dominates these cultural symbols. The implication is that some humans are vital to this culture, but not all of them. One more way of judging the cultural importance of humanity is to look at the aspirations of humans. What is it they want to achieve in the long run? It is certainly not a universal truth that all humans aspire to something beyond living their lives in a regular way. What can you possibly aspire to if your life is deeply fulfilling? In Western cultures, on the other hand, aspirations to greatness have driven technological and social development to places where, without the desire for greatness, they would never have reached, for better or worse. In Western educational systems, and also those of many other modern cultures, it is assumed that people want to become something, such as a lawyer, doctor or hairdresser, before they have even reached their teenage years. Presumably many people's aspirations are going to be cut tragically short due to the kinds of activities I mentioned above. But there must be more than just commerce if humans really are vital. Michio Kaku, author of Parallel Worlds, is a highly respected cosmologist who dabbles in philosophy. He views humans as having enormous potential for good, even beyond the lifespan of the Earth, but has severe doubts about our current efforts to realise that potential. Beyond carrying out useful work and giving or receiving love, two vital ingredients, he says, in ensuring humans are fulfilled, he sees two other key factors that, in my mind, make the difference between whether humans are vital or just relevant. He says, first, to fulfil whatever talents we are born with, however blessed we are by fate with different abilities and strengths, we should try to develop them to the fullest rather than allow them to atrophy and decay. Second, we should try to leave the world a better place than we entered it. As individuals, we can make a difference, whether it's to probe the secrets of nature, to clean up the environment and work for peace and social justice, or to nurture the inquisitive, vibrant spirit of the young by being a mentor and a guide. Does this culture fulfil all of Michio Kaku's requirements? If so, then I can without hesitation pronounce human beings as vital. But it's not true, is it? The culture doesn't truly care for the environment. It doesn't give equal opportunity for all to fulfil the range of their talents. It does not provide widespread provision for nurturing mentors and guides. This culture as a whole does not even value love in any obvious capacity, certainly nowhere near as much as it values economic work. The 2005 European Working Conditions Survey found that an average of 83% of workers were either very satisfied or satisfied with their working conditions. Interestingly, when asked about job opportunities to learn and grow, i.e. the job mentors and guides them, only 54% of respondents agreed that this was a factor in job satisfaction. An awful lot of people don't see work as a means of self-improvement. Perhaps there's a message there. Is it just serendipity that the New Economics Foundation's Happy Planet Index has managed to take account of almost every one of the above factors and package them into a convenient measure of how much a culture, in the shape of individual nations, views humanity as a going concern? Possibly not. Unsurprisingly, we have to return to happiness as the key factor in judging the well-being of humanity. Neither is it entirely surprising that the Happy Planet map shows that the countries most dominated by the Western industrial capitalist culture, the USA, Australia, Canada, Western Europe, score as badly as those countries suffering from abject poverty or political repression. In fact, despite us being told that happiness is something you can buy in a shop, China comes out better than any of these other areas. Political repression aside, the people of China still manage, at the moment, to be planet happier than much of the rest of the world. What I especially like about the Happy Planet Index is that a culture that is environmentally destructive will, on balance, come out worse than a culture that is not. You cannot value humans if you're making the environmental conditions they live in unbearable. According to the 2007 list, Vanuatu, Colombia and Costa Rica come out on top, closely followed by Dominica and Panama. To find the countries that are most closely associated with the predominant culture, you need to go all the way down to Austria at 61. The UK is at 108, sandwiched between Laos and Libya. The USA is at 150, admittedly brought down with a tremendous bump by its massive environmental impact. In some cultures, humans are considered to be no more than relevant, largely because the rest of life is considered to be just as important. In other cultures, humans are considered to be transcendent, right at the top of existence. Yet, such cultures also manage to treat the natural environment with sufficient care as to not be grievously damaged. The predominant culture in which exists the majority of financially wealthy nations and is having an increasing influence on billions more people seems to put humans right at the centre of things. But somehow, it has conspired to treat the majority of humans as not really relevant at all. As far as industrial civilization, the dominant culture, is concerned, humans were never going to be judged as vital. I'm afraid it was a bit of a fix. We're merely relevant. The personal test. How would you feel if you were dead? If ever there was a non-question, then this is surely it. But it's still worth asking. Critical to ask, in fact, because unless we know how we feel about our death, then we cannot possibly know the answer to the next question. Does it matter to us if we are not here? I want to take you aside for a short moment to discuss the past and the future. Imagine for a moment that you're going to undergo an operation, one that will lead to a great deal of discomfort for a few days, requiring heavy doses of morphine in order to make the pain bearable. Unless you're the kind of person who thrives on pain, and there are such people, then the chances are you will need some support from others, a range of distractions and quite a lot of tea or coffee leading up to the operation. Once the operation is complete, then, as I've said, there is pain. But eventually the pain goes, and you're better off for the procedure that has been carried out. If you look back on that operation, you may feel a pang of emotion, maybe even a phantom memory of pain, but you won't actually feel the pain as it was, nor will you look back to the event in the same way that you're forced to look forward to it. Time travels forwards, and so we do too. The human body has various tricks it can pull to ensure we are in tune with the incessant movement of time. One of them is hormonal, and every new mother would have experienced this trick under normal circumstances. When a woman is giving birth, large amounts of various hormones are released into the bloodstream. One of these hormones is called oxytocin, and it is this hormone that prepares the mother to be for both the second stage of childbirth, the delivery itself, and the essential task of breastfeeding. During the most strenuous and painful stages, an odd thing happens. The pituitary gland that sits just behind the forehead releases further chemicals known as endorphins. The result is a decrease in pain perception, quite naturally. The rising level of endorphins also contributes to a shift from a thinking, rational mindset to a more instinctive one. Endorphins create a dreamlike state, which appears to help women in the tasks required for giving birth. Natural birth, without artificial chemicals, may be a question of taste, but there is little doubt that the natural chemicals the human body is able to produce make childbirth a more bearable process. Now here's the really clever part. The endorphin rush not only reduces pain, but it also acts to suppress the memory of that pain, and many other aspects of the birth itself. This effect is not unique to childbirth. In fact, there are countless documented cases of people who have undergone grievous injuries, immense tests of stamina and traumatic incidents who just can't remember the pain of these events. Why would this be beneficial? If you think about the kinds of situations during which pain-reducing endorphins are released, then it becomes clear that pain memory would not be helpful in most cases. Undoubtedly, the visual and other sensory aspects of an event may remain vivid, I still feel tense inside when I recall the time I sliced the edge off my left index finger with a Stanley knife when cutting a piece of card. But the pain does not. I have no memory at all of the pain. So while I will be more careful with the sharp blade in the future, based on my memories of the event, I cannot tell you how much that knife incident hurt. With childbirth, it is critical for the DNA to be able to replicate. So the evolutionary process that has led to endorphins being released ensures that a woman can remember many of the sights, smells and sounds of previous births, but crucially, cannot remember the pain that would otherwise discourage her from trying for another baby. It seems that we have evolved to only remember the parts of the past that it is worth remembering. Another trick that humans have developed, working out how you would test for this in any other organism is challenging to say the least, is our ability to treat the future as more important than the past. Time is a concept that philosophers and more recently scientists have struggled with for millennia. There is an organisation called the International Society for the Study of Time that presumably talks about nothing but time, and have been doing so for over 40 years with seemingly little agreement. I love this quote from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Time has been studied by philosophers and scientists for 2,500 years, and thanks to this attention it is much better understood today. Nevertheless, many issues remain to be resolved. Here is a short list of the most important ones. What time actually is, whether time exists when nothing is changing, what kinds of time travel are possible, whether the future and past are real, and so on. Maybe the author has had his or her irony gland removed, or maybe they forgot to read what they had just written, but it's pretty obvious that time is something we understand very poorly. We do know that time is distinct from space, inasmuch as you can travel forwards and backwards in space, but you cannot travel backwards in time. The notional fourth dimension tag given to time is merely a convenience based on the fact that humans are three-dimensional beings. If we were two-dimensional, then A, we would treat the third dimension differently to the way we do as three-dimensional beings, and B, laying gas, sewage and water pipes to houses would be an absolute nightmare. Maybe if we were four or five or six dimensional beings, then time travel would be a breeze, but only relative to beings that exist in fewer dimensions. Not being able to move backwards in time may seem like a bind, but anyone who has watched Doctor Who or Back to the Future will understand why it's probably a good thing that we can't go back in time and alter the course of events. Regardless of my overwhelming desire to go back to 1980 and present to every student what we now know about climate change. My younger daughter became very upset when she realised that if my wife and I had never been born, or had never met, or had not decided to go to Dover one New Year's Day, she would never have been born. Such thoughts are of no practical use, and rarely trouble the adult mind. The fact that we are always moving forwards through time, eating up our future as it becomes our present and then our past, means that it would be completely pointless for us to have evolved a fear of the past. I fear the future. I would not be writing this book if that were not the case. But I'm only aware of what has happened in the past. The aforementioned painful operation, once it has occurred, merely becomes a memory of something that can never happen again. The point of all this discussion about time is to give you another perspective on top of the spatial one you read about in Chapter 8. We should not only see ourselves as relatively insignificant when it comes to knowing our place in the tree of life, we also need to put the past into perspective. By all means, we can learn from it, reflect on it, and enjoy the memories it has given us, but what matters to us will not happen in the past. It will happen in the future. Ask yourself the question again. Does it matter to us if we are not here? Remember the discussion about selfishness in Chapter 9. The conclusion of this was that selfishness is unsustainable, and that we must take account of other things in order to ensure that our behaviour does not lead to unsustainability. Sustainability is not just about the use of natural resources, it is about the use of our lives. If we do not survive, then our DNA will not survive. Therefore, our DNA will have failed in its role as replicators of information. If you are thinking we can deny our genetic information, then go ahead, do something fatal. Take a knife or a rope or some non-prescription drugs and deny your DNA their inbuilt destiny. It's not something that anyone would carry out lightly, nor is it something that happens very often. Suicide, although relatively more common amongst older men, is not a leading cause of death on a global scale. The World Health Organization estimates that suicide accounts for less than 2% of all deaths, 90% of whom have been diagnosed with a psychological condition, which would increase the likelihood of the sufferer taking their own life. It is worrying to note, though, that the global rate of suicide has been steadily on the increase, up by 40% among females and 60% among males since 1950. Economic pressure and social fragmentation in a culture in which the words "there is no such thing as society" have become iconic have no small part to play in this trend. Studies in a wide range of cultures have consistently found a close negative relationship between the personal value people place on material wealth and their psychological health. Depression appears to be less common amongst people who don't live their lives in the pursuit of wealth. The role that religion plays in the question of suicide is fascinating. It would be tempting to think that a religious belief that has part of its articles of faith the existence of an afterlife will be rife with followers eager to take the next step towards a divine future. It is significant, as I hinted earlier at the beginning of this chapter, that all the world's major religions treat suicide as a mortal sin or its equivalent, which draws the conclusion that the founders of such doctrines were not too keen on their followers taking a shortcut to eternity. Was this a conscious or superconscious decision to maintain the natural desire to preserve life? Certainly the presence of willing volunteers in suicide bomb attacks is testament to the power of religious belief to overcome the natural desire to survive, both for the perpetrator and the victims. Were it not for certain types of religious indoctrination, such attacks would be far less common. The rarity of suicide overall and the prevalence of psychological problems amongst those who do commit suicide makes a very strong case for humans as being natural survivors. If this were not the case, then humans would have died out long ago through natural processes, much like any other organism that, through a lack of viable, healthy, adaptable DNA, no longer exists. More than just our natural tendency to survive, though, is the manifestation of that survival instinct in the way we think. Consider the question, what would you risk your life to save? My initial instinct is to say, my family, then me, then, with a little more thought, the earth in general, and my friends. Remove the earth from the equation and you have the kind of answer that most people give. In fact, all three typical responses are directly related to the natural instinct for survival. We want to protect our family in order to secure the continuation of our DNA through blood relatives and the people they depend upon to survive. We want to protect ourselves in order to protect our own DNA and the opportunity for that to be further replicated. We want to protect our friends because they too are human beings. But not only that, we have consciously chosen our closest friends because of what they have in common with us. They are almost like family. It might seem crass to bring all of this down to genes and DNA, but it makes perfect sense when you think about it. When a male spider mates with a female, it has to adopt various strategies to ensure that it will not be eaten or killed prior to inseminating its mate. Its utmost priority is to ensure its DNA gets passed on to the next generation of spiders. Male redback spiders that are doomed to die following mating have developed a method of carrying out dual insemination, a remarkable adaptation that counters the female's ability to choose between the sperm of different mates. The even more remarkable thing is that the adaptation does not ensure that the male spider himself survives. In fact, the extended mating time makes death even more likely. The spider is simply ensuring that his DNA has the best possible chance of surviving. This is the way of nature, and we are simply following nature's rules. The ecology test shows that humans, however successful in evolutionary terms, are irrelevant to the continuation of the Earth's ecosystem. The cultural test showed that although the dominant culture on the planet puts humans above all else, it is not treating humans as though we were vital. We are merely relevant. The personal test has given another outcome entirely. Humans are the ultimate expression of all we hold dear, and nothing else comes before us. The outcome of both the ecology test and the cultural test could change dramatically depending on how we treat both the earth and how we treat ourselves. We could choose to live lives that are fully sustainable and give all the other species on earth the ability to exist according to the rules of nature, rather than the toxic rules we have drawn up. We could choose to live in a culture that values humans as individuals, treats them equally, and does not threaten our very existence through its destructive activities. But we can never change what we are. Survivors. In the end, surely what matters is what matters to us.